Hey, it's Gary. I thought I would start with something different. I know I always start with, hey, everyone, it's Gary. I cannot think of something different to start this with, so I just left out a word. That's as creative and risky as I could be at the moment. So, hey, I'm so glad you're joining us on this, and this is going to be a lot of fun to do this with one of our base camp members, Jonathan Poole, who some of you have chatted with, talked with. You know, you've been seeing his picture since Monday on the front page, and I wanted to gather a couple pictures to give you a feel for who Jonathan is. And by the time we're done, you'll know much more about him. So, Jonathan, first of all, thank you for doing this with us on the phone where people can hear your voice, and hopefully we'll get into some of your story.
Oh, thanks, Gary. I'm really looking forward to this. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah. Hey, so real quickly, explain to us the pictures. Give us a little context. What's going on with each of those pictures and why those pictures were on your website and therefore now on our front page?
Okay. All right. Well, I think the left one is relatively self-explanatory. That's just me. That's pretty much what I look like right now. The beard came from, I broke my leg a year and a half ago, and I grew it kind of as like a rally beard. You know how when the baseball teams are in the pennant, they won't shave, and it stuck. So the beard is still with me. Kevin Miller from Free Agent Academy says, well, it makes you look professorial. And since I am that professor of idea and opportunity in FAA, the beard has stuck. So the one in the top center is Lake Michigan, our giant freshwater sea that we have here. I live five blocks from the water here, base of a bay in Traverse City in northern Michigan, and then a half an hour from the Lake Michigan coastline where you can't see Wisconsin on the other side. It's a 190-mile fetch from Chicago to the south, and I'm kiteboarding. And for those who don't know what kiteboarding is like wakeboarding, where you have a board on your feet. You can see it on my feet there. But instead of getting towed by a boat, I am getting towed around. I actually am in control of a very, very large kite. And so it's a type of sailing, but it's using a very big kite that I have the ability to steer and guide, and I have the ability to jump. And kiting for me is freedom. I'm harnessing the power of the wind. I get to just have total freedom of expression on the waves, and the jumping is the closest thing to flying that I've done. There's a pretty good hang time with jumping. It's similar to what a paraglider would do. Once you've got the altitude, you can kind of float down. So I get to jump and watch my shadow on the wave as the wave passes underneath me. So I thoroughly enjoy that.
Okay, so let me ask you, how do you start? I mean, you've got to somehow start with that kite, your kite gaining wind and getting up in the air. How do you start?
That's a great question. And for anyone who has flown a two-line stunt kite, the stunt kite will have two lines to it, one from the right side, one from the left side. And by putting more tension on one side versus the other, the kite is steerable. And when you fly a kite, if the wind is at your back, you can fly that kite anywhere within that quarter sphere that you can move your arms. You know, from the horizon all the way out to your right side, all the way out to the left side, to straight overhead. Where you place that kite determines how much power it generates. So we call it, if I'm looking straight ahead with the wind at my back and I put my arms straight out to either side and then bring them up over my head, that's what we call the edge of the window. I can't fly the kite behind my head. But that's the edge of the window. That's where the kite is the least powerful. If I put the kite straight downwind of me, that's where the kite has tremendous power. So I'll start with the kite resting overhead at the edge of the window where it doesn't generate a lot of power. And then I'll turn it straight down and dive it right through, we call it the center of the window, and it's going to pull as hard as a boat would pull me out of the water. And then if I don't correct that kite, it's going to yank me right off of my feet and tow me like I'm tied behind a boat going 25 miles an hour. I turn the kite back up and move it to the spot that I need to generate as much power as necessary to ride. And then I'm edging against the power of the kite, and that's how I'm able to maintain my ground and work up wind. So it is the analogy, Gary, of rubbing your head and your stomach at the same time. It applies to this. You have to be able to control the kite at the same time that you're controlling how you edge the board, how you ride, how you're modifying your stance on the board to control the pull, the power of the kite. And it takes a little while to get used to doing those two things seamlessly at once.
Okay.
But
okay.
Once,
now, go ahead.
Once you have it down, it's so graceful. It is. I gravitate to the sports that allow freedom of expression, and kiting, a friend of mine calls it, it's freedom of expression in three dimensions.
Hmm.
So that's why I love it.
It looks amazing. So, okay, now before you get into the next picture, and maybe this is where the next picture comes into play, Jeff Andresian's asking, how did you break your leg?
So another thing that people will learn very quickly about me is I don't do things the conventional way. So I ski downhill, but not on alpine ski gear. I'm a telemark skier, which is what's known as Nordic downhill. So my heels are loose, and I do a different style turn, telemark turn. And I've never alpine skied. My family did not alpine ski. We cross-country skied, and my adrenaline gene, I wanted to go downhills fast and needed to learn how to do it in control. So telemark skiing just kind of morphed from that. I broke my leg in a very freak accident telemark skiing. It was very unusual. I like to say all of my injuries have been JRAs, and JRA stands for just riding along. I was just riding along, and this happened. I had a very unusual kind of windmill fall that just put a ton of torque on my lower leg, and I broke my leg right above my ankle. So that was December of 2009, and so spent a good amount of time in a cast
on
crutches and then walking around on it a little bit.
Okay.
So.
Okay, the next picture.
The next picture on the right, I'm on a bicycle, and you can't totally see it, but that bike has no seat. Remember I told you I don't do things the conventional way? This is called bike trials, and bike trials is the art of balance on two wheels, and you don't always have to use two wheels. I'm on the edge of a ledge, and I'm just balancing comfortably there, and will drop off of that ledge when I'm ready. I had a friend who could ride his bike over anything, never put his foot down. And I was just intrigued. I love the challenge of doing that. And was asking him, his name was John. I was like, John, how do you do that? And he's like, oh, bike trials. And he named this guy who was this Spanish 10-time bike trial world champion that I didn't even know what was. And I got hooked. It was something I could practice in my backyard. And it is. It's the art of balance, being able to balance and move your bike fluidly over anything. And so that's what I'm doing. I do that regularly. If you could see my backyard right now, I have a local group of riders that I've built up here in a little organization called Two Wheel Technique, and we put demonstrations on throughout the summer, and we have a demo this Saturday at a local mountain bike race. And so we've got the whole demo set up in my backyard, and the guys are coming over and practicing in the evenings to get ready for the show. So
that's
what I'm doing there.
That's so fascinating. I've seen competitions, I mean, I can't remember when, but on TV, and I was amazed at what people were doing. I mean, absolutely, it was unbelievable to me. And I loved it because it looked like gymnastics in many ways.
Yes.
Artful, on your own, figure out how to do this, and I mean, so far the two things you have are just similar to the kind of genre of gymnastics.
It is. It's with gymnastics, from what I know, and I'm correlating it to what I know with what I do, you have to have that body awareness, and then it's learning how to move your body in a way that allows you to attain what other people look at and say it's impossible. And so many people look at what we do on the bike, and a couple of my riders, they can statically be balancing on their bike next to a 48-inch high ledge and just hop straight up sideways and land on it. And it's just it's using their body. They compress and then just explode upwards, and then have the ability to move the bike up and over to the side and move the bike where the bike goes even further than their body does to be able to make it up on that ledge. And they look like a cat. And it's the same with gymnastics when you see the individuals and you use the energy that you've generated by moving forward to then change it into that vertical direction and just get phenomenal height.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of thing, that awareness of being able to do it. So very, very, very similar. And you would probably pick this up and be very good.
Oh, well, it looks really fun. I'm going to have to think about this summer. Okay, so next picture.
So the picture in the lower in the middle, I'm teaching there, and if you can make it out, there's a whole line of these big easel pads, the 24 by 30-something easel pads. And I'm pointing out something. This is what I call a wall of perspective. The work that I do with groups and with individuals, designed to help them get clarity and truth on who they are at the core, is based on looking at the perspective of one's life. And I am really big on the need to be able to see it all at once. The definition of perspective is seeing all the relevant data at one time, or seeing all the data in a relevant way. And to be able to do that, when there is so much power, when you put someone's life story up on the wall and there's the ability to see the threads and themes in there of things that they've done and they've done innately well, and the threads and themes in there that point to patterns that are repeating themselves, and a lot of times they can be patterns that keep us stuck. There's just tremendous power in being able to see that. So that's, you've seen me do it, you've heard me talk about it a lot, but that's, I kind of preach the importance of that wall of perspective when I'm working with individuals and groups.
Yeah.
So that's me doing it.
Okay, good. Okay, now let me jump into a quote. Let me read a quote from your website, from you, that I sent to all the guys. You've seen it. But let me read this, and I'd love for you to talk about that, because what I'd like to do is talk about who you are today and what motivates you and what you're doing, and then I'd love to go back and kind of follow the thread of desire and that type of thing. So here is what I sent to everyone that you wrote. You said, "I am formally trained as an engineer, and my degree is from the University of Notre Dame. After less than 4 years as an employee, every part of me rebelled. It is not my place in a 9-to-5 world. My physical condition and entrepreneurial spirit led me away from employmentdom and my own path, and on my own path." Okay, so tell us a little more about that.
Okay. And I've written that with the hindsight of many years of experience. At the time, I did not recognize how my body was, all of my fibers were rebelling against what was happening. I developed limiting physical pain 3.5 years after graduating from school and working for a traditional engineering consulting firm. It developed out of the blue. Over a 9-month period, it ramped up in intensity to the point that it really shut me down. I didn't have the ability to be a benefit for the firm anymore. I could not tolerate the pain. I couldn't sit for an extended period of time, stand. My recovery posture was torso horizontal, essentially, and then my pain would slowly subside. And so in a short period of time, it really shut me down. So my body was rebelling against that. There's a deeper story to it as well, but I look back now and I was looking for a way out and had no idea how to get out of the pathway that I was in. I was incredibly successful in the world's eyes. I graduated from a top university at the high end of the class. I had a very good job. I had a ton of responsibility, and there was a huge part of it that just did not fit. But I didn't recognize it, Gary. I didn't know that. And my body knew it better than my mind did. And so as it played out, it forced me. I'd always had a desire to own my own business. I'd had a lot of entrepreneurial ideas as a kid that had not been encouraged, and so I'd never really pursued them. So I wasn't on the pathway to start my own business, but it certainly happened that way.
Okay, so let me ask you, so we have context. What are you what is your work now that you're doing, that you do and also provides for you financially?
So, and this is recent too. So now there are three roles that I have. As you know, in the context of the Free Agent Academy, I am the professor of idea and opportunity. So I'm the third class courseware that individuals who are looking to find self-employment that will truly fit them. Your class is the first foundation class, calling, then it goes to you, and then it comes to me, to IDEA. My role there, 80% of what I do is helping individuals really uncover, and I use uncover instead of discover because I believe it's there. It's just uncovering it, uncovering who they are at the core, so that then we can look at ideas that interest them and filter them against who they are at the core. So I do that in the context of Free Agent Academy. I do the same principles with individuals one-on-one. Those who do not have clarity on truth on who they are at the core, what they're naturally great at, what gives them meaning and purpose or their heart, and this is where you and I overlap and align so much, I help them with the tools, the ability to see that clearly so that they can move forward with confidence. And my training comes from a gentleman named Tom Patterson. Mm-hmm. And Tom has a saying, when you are in perspective, you have clarity and truth. When you are in perspective, the plan writes itself. He says that from a business standpoint, but it applies from a personal standpoint as well. When you really know where you've been and how you got to where you are now, there is great clarity that's gained in where you are headed, what you must do to head there. And so that's what I do for others. I do it in the context of groups as well. I teach at the local community college and then do interactives in a group setting. I do it with adults. I've got a strong affinity for young adults because I look at the story of my life and say, if I had the tools that I have now 20 years ago, the direction of my life would have been different. And so I do intensives, small group intensives, call them Find Your Fit intensives for young adults as well. So that, in a nutshell, is what I'm doing. It comes out of my personal journey is why I'm doing it today.
Okay. All right. So you're doing, I mean, I know from talking to you, and I think everybody can tell from your voice, you are doing what you love. This is what you're compelled to do. It brings life to do this.
And after I had 20 years in as a consulting engineer, I was very good at what I did. I was highly proficient, but it didn't give me meaning and purpose. And so it's so wonderful to be in a position where what I do gives me meaning It's just it is. To have confirmation from someone like you where you can see it and sense it in me is just wonderful, because I was dead to it for years and years and years.
Okay. So there's my question then. How did you awaken to that? What happened between being dead to it and being awakened to it? And then I want to ask you how you went from awakened to it to where you are. But right now, how did you kind of awaken to that? Now, it sounds like, first of all, the physical pain you had was an awakening element, it sounds like to me, part of it.
You know what? No, I think I was... I was so dead, there was a level that I did not recognize what it was telling me. So let me give you some backstory. I developed my physical pain. I had to leave from working as an employee. I needed to spend a good part of my day reclined in order to recover from my pain. I was forced to figure out how I could work flat on my back, and I figured it out. I designed a monitor stand, and I supported a 95-pound, 19-inch monitor back when we didn't have flat screens that was above my head so that I could work, do my engineering, do my CAD work. But I stepped right back into what I knew. Engineering was what I knew. I felt that that was the only way that I could make a living. And so I had great experience in a short period of time. So I was in a position to be able to step back into it. People knew what I could do. And so I built my practice. But I had this, I call it the cycle of unrest, that every 2 years there would just be this overwhelming unrest and something would have to change. But what I did was I changed within the context of what I knew. So within engineering, I changed the type of work I did multiple times. I really refined what I did until I had a very specific niche and not a lot of competition. I changed the type of client I worked for, and yet I still would have this unrest. I lived in Southeast Michigan in a suburb of Detroit and loved the outdoors. My time was very limited with my pain, and I felt trapped in suburbia. So I moved to Traverse City because it was where I wanted to live. I took a big risk on my practice and made the decision to move, and I took some key clients with me, but moved to where I wanted to live. I felt that that was going to solve the unrest, and 2 years after I was here, I had the same unrest. So what it did, that I made a bunch of changes. I was at a very good position professionally, well-respected, made good money, lived where I wanted to live, and I still had this unrest.
Okay, now how old are you about this point?
That was 2008. I am 49 now, so it was 45, 46. I will say the unrest, it took me 2 years to wind out my client commitment, so it was probably in that 43 age range that it was pressing on me. And I knew that I needed to make a vocational change. I also had all kinds of pieces in place to help me know myself, but I could not see how they would fit. And I recognized that I needed to step out of engineering to be able to clear my head and look at vocational possibilities. So I made plans to take a sabbatical from work, which was 2008. And what the genesis of the change for me at the start of that process, a friend of mine had just been certified in the process by Tom Patterson that I'm trained to do now. That's the 2-day intensive process with individuals. And this individual said, I think this would benefit you. And I was at the start of my sabbatical. I had nothing to lose and said, absolutely, I'll do it. So I committed to the 2 days. We went through the perspective of my life. We identified the threads that pointed to what I was naturally great at, and I saw how I used them in my engineering, but I saw how I didn't use all of them all the time. I uncovered my heart, and my heart is with making a tangible difference for individuals. and I was in a profession that made a difference for things, and that just opened my eyes to recognize the source of the unrest. I was doing something that did not give me meaning and purpose. The other thing that came out of it, by looking at the perspective of my life, I saw patterns and themes that just repeated themselves over and over again. And I recognized that I was going to repeat them until I died if I didn't do something about it. And the two big patterns, the first one was I had an incredible disdain for authority, and I had rejected mentorship at every turn, both personally and professionally. I had this incredibly strong go-it-alone streak, and I saw how it had cost me dearly over and over again, and I was going to repeat it if I didn't do something about it. I had a pattern of failure in relationship where every relationship ended the same way. I hadn't seen it before, whether I ended it or the woman ended it. They ended the same way, and I looked at that and said, I don't have the tools. I'm just going to repeat this over and over again unless I get to the heart of what's going on. So that was really the genesis of what started me on this really significant journey to say, okay, there's a vocational component of it, but there's a lot deeper personal component to this as well.
Mm-hmm. You know what's fascinating is, as I'm hearing you tell the story, and Jack Lindy was the one asking about your age, you know, we put this, with a friend of mine, Paul Stanley, put together this life development stages, and I'm looking at it right now, and so in the 30s, the typical question is, where is my place? And that very much usually deals with a place in the work world, like I'm an engineer, I'm a teacher, I'm a pilot, I'm a, you know, whatever that is, I'm a doctor, I'm a... But the idea is that when somewhere in your 40s, no exact line, but there is this, the question now turns to, but why am I here? Which is a much deeper question than where's my place?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's what's really in me, because either, you know, the places we've been in may have been successful, may not have been, but either way, it's going to get to, but why am I here? This is what I have to pursue. And it sounds so similar to that.
Mm.
Right? Because you were successful. I mean, you were doing well, but you just knew you couldn't stay there that much longer and maintain your life.
I couldn't.
Your heart.
And honestly, Gary, I had been there so long. So what I did forensic engineering or expert problem solving. So I was the engineer of last resort. When other people couldn't solve it, they would refer out to me. And I loved the challenge of doing that. I recognized that in order to keep my head in the game, I was taking riskier and riskier work because it was the only thing that could keep me motivated. And I was to the point where I was going to take something risky enough that I would fail and be liable for it. And I see Alex asked a great question saying, making that kind of change takes courage. What gave you the courage to take the leap? And, Alex, I was at the end of my rope. I knew that there was a significant part of me that was dying, and it was I'm willing to risk whatever it takes because this is death to stay here, to continue to do this. If I stay here, if I keep repeating these patterns, I will always fail in relationship. I will always be going it alone, doing it alone. And so that's what really opened the door for it. I was long enough in that and misaligned long enough that I was at the end of my rope.
Hmm. Now, Jonathan, I'm actually going to unmute Jeff Andresian. This is taking a huge risk. and Jeff, you are unmuted right now, and you have this great question, and I think you need to ask it because Jonathan may want to ask a clarifying question back to you. So go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, hey Jonathan, it's so good to hear your story and about kite sailing and kite boarding and all that stuff. We got to hang out, you know. I look forward to that.
I would love to do that.
We got to take you down the Gauley River in West Virginia. I really think you'd love that.
I would, and that's something I do not have much experience in. So I will take you up on that. How soon can we book that?
September. They run every September, October, so it's a dam release, so it's just 2 months out of the year. But it's the
Let's
number
make
two
that
river
happen.
In the United States. It is absolutely beautiful.
And Jeff, excuse me, please don't swear on these calls like you just did, okay?
Anyway,
talk about any damn releases, okay?
Okay.
Right, go ahead.
All right, thanks. Got it. All right. Hey, well, listen, I love the idea that if you could be self-employed, then you should be self-employed. Is self-employment for everyone?
Wow, that's a great question, and that's a significant one. And Kevin Miller, the founder of Free Agent Academy, does believe that strongly, that the ability to control one's own destiny is significant, and that it's only through self-employment that can occur. My experience with individuals, I've got a different opinion. I believe there are many people who long for and desire and have the ability to be self-employed, and societal pressure, the risk that's involved with it, prevents them from doing it. But I don't think it's every person. I see and work with individuals who are in organizations, and they thrive because they are able to be right in their sweet spot within the organization, and other members of the organization are responsible for what they aren't strong at. I have a very strong entrepreneurial spirit. I love the freedom and flexibility. I love the responsibility and the risk that comes with doing it. Not everyone thrives on risk, and self-employment has a significant level of risk. And so I look at it from that standpoint. If a significant level of risk is something that just stops you cold, it's not something that you would step into, enjoy, self-employment may not be the best pathway.
Okay, so let me ask you this. You know, I've got my son, Ben. He's 20, and, you know, we took him to an art institute because he wants to do videography, and basically, you know, just the tuition alone was $21,500 for a year. And I'm looking at that, and then I'm looking at the idea that he could take an internship, possibly, and instead of spending all that money for school, set him up for his own business. So almost immediately, he's taking more responsibility because it's his own business. But if he's in an internship, possibly getting enough training while I guess there's that. And that has to be for each individual. How much training does an individual need before he can be self-employed? Would you suggest that for a 20-year-old? I know you have a passion for that.
That's another great question. And that's a
there's
big
a lot of
one.
Training and education at that age.
That's a great question. And there's let me address it two ways. There's two prongs to that. One of them is from the educational pathway, and I need to give you some background. I've been called Mr. Pool way more prior to being 21 years of age than I have in the rest of my life. I was the kinesthetic kid who struggled to sit still, and in the formal educational environment, sitting still was what was valued and was considered necessary in order to absorb and take information in. So I followed that traditional pathway all the way through because that was what was appropriate. That was what was deemed appropriate, and it was what was given value within my family. I am a hands-on experiential learner. I learn very well on my own. There are times where I need input from others, but not always. I think it really comes down to the individual. How do they learn? And then what is the best way for them to be able to process that information? I see many, many people who follow a traditional education pathway, and they don't get to the application portion until they're three quarters of the way through, and it's through the application that they discover they really don't enjoy it. And so my personal take on it, what I like to see with someone who has a strong interest is to be able to get enough exposure to it in an experiential way that they've got greater clarity to say, oh, okay, this makes sense. And then for me, with the education, if the education gets you, is a necessary part of getting you to where you want to be, then by all means. So if we looked at my story, if I had the clarity at a young age, I've got an aptitude for engineering. I thoroughly enjoy it. I've had some experience with it from an internship or whatever, and I see the ability to do this, and I want to build a business around it. I absolutely have to get the degree, and I have to go on and do my licensing, and so it's necessary for the educational process. But I'm going into it knowing this is what I want to do. So I see with the cost of education these days, the ability to do a very wise interim step to give clarity for oneself and to also gain clarity on what that education can do. Okay, this degree is going to be the best, and these schools tend to have the greatest platform for doing it. And I'm gonna target those three because that's what's gonna help me. Then you're making a very wise decision. I also feel really strongly. I've said earlier tonight, if I had the tools that I have now when I was in my 20s, the direction of my life would have been different. I was very good at math and science. I'm very hands-on. People looked at those three things and said engineering. What they didn't bring into the mix was the relational component that's very significant for me. And because that component wasn't brought into the mix, it wasn't recognized. Engineering looked like the best pathway, and it looked like the best one to me, too, at the time. And so being able to have that clarity of who you are, all of the components where you can see how they fit, and then be able to move forward with confidence, I think, is key.
Hey, Jonathan, thank you, man. That was excellent and very clarifying for me. It gives me a lot of help. And, hey, maybe we'll get a chance to talk more about it and some of the other
Absolutely.
Guys have some great questions coming up. So thank you.
Thanks,
okay.
Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff, great question there. Okay, let me ask you, and we've got some more questions in here, but I want to ask you the next question. So, okay, you were kind of on your path of how did you get to where you are today that, you know, you were talking about that you did make some shifts as you're realizing more who you were, but they were more, you were making changes within what you already knew, so they weren't significant changes into
yes.
offering who you really are. These cycles of unrest, you were talking about that. So that you discovered you wanted to make a tangible difference for individuals. So keep going a little bit further, and then we'll come back to some of these other questions.
Oh, okay. So and help me out so that I know I'm responding to your question. The unrest within my profession was occurring and until I had the clarity from doing the life plan process at the start of my sabbatical and then stepping into the patterns that had kept me there, correct?
Right.
Okay.
And well, now, since you mentioned sabbatical, there was a question because this is a really good one and it will go with, because my curiosity is what did you do on that? Sam Williamson asked this question. He said, I can see the strong theme of personal reflection with Jonathan. Can you ask him how valuable is this and what disciplines has he learned to practice it? What did you do during that sabbatical time and what do you do as of today?
Oh, great, great question. So, Sam, I was a workaholic. I worked all the time. There was a part of me that recognized that I was not going to find a new vocational direction without stopping work and freeing some space up. And it was freeing the space up that gave me the ability to start to do personal reflection in a significant way, really for the first time in my life. And what came out of it, there's one other component that I want to share here so that people really clearly see what was the kickstarter into my sabbatical. I did the life plan process, the personal reflection, looking at the perspective of my life, which was the first time that I'd really stepped back and looked at my life as a whole, let me see what I was great at, but it also let me see those patterns that were just sabotaging me, keeping me stuck. Two other things occurred in a short period after that. One of them was I read a book that was written by a physician called Healing Back Pain, the Mind-Body Connection. And he was an MD who did back surgery, and he'd done a lot of back surgery for people with very specific symptoms, bulging discs, nerve impingement, everything, and the surgery hadn't alleviated their pain. And it sent him on a journey to find out why, and he came to his own understanding of the physical manifestation of emotional pain. And he wrote the book to say, if you've got these symptoms, before you get surgery, is there anything that you have that could be causing emotional pain, take a look at it. I did not have the symptoms that were described in the book, but it made me question, could my physical pain, where I did not have a specific diagnosis, I had many possibilities, but nothing that was clear cut, could my pain be emotional pain? I don't have emotional pain, but it just opened the door for me to think about that. The third thing that happened was that my sister shared with me for the first time in her life that she had battled depression for years and at one point had been suicidal. And the best way I can describe it, I grew up in a perfect people family. We only showed our good side. And so for her to show her vulnerability was very, very significant. I have one other sibling, I have a younger brother, and I knew that he had struggled with depression. His second year in college had really struggled with it, but it was a subject we just didn't talk about in the family. So I was staring in the face all three siblings with what could be outward manifestation of inward pain. Depression commonly is outward manifestation of inward pain. Could my physical pain be outward manifestation of inward pain? So I went and sought the wisest professional counsel that I could find and sat down and said, I've lived with this for 20 years. I don't see it. I don't recognize it, but I'm here to find out if this could be a possibility. And so that started the journey of significant personal reflection. My sabbatical year, which was going to be to sort of try on different vocational possibilities, gain clarity, and move in a new direction, became the year of personal growth and significant personal reflection. And it was the first time in my life that I turned off all of my coping mechanisms to not be able to feel the pain, the emotional pain that I did have. And the best way I can put it, and this is really significant, Gary, I believe as children, we were created by God and we innately know what truth is. Yet if we're taught that what we know to be true isn't true, we lose our ability for a healthy radar of discerning truth. And that's the story in my family. There was significant unhealth and we were taught not to see the truth for what it is, not to recognize the elephant in the room. And so my journey of personal reflection was stepping back and looking, recognizing things and saying, oh my gosh, is that really what it is? and putting the pieces together to recognize the truth for what it is.
Okay, that's amazing. I mean, your statement of I refused to go to coping mechanisms, that I was going to face the pain openly and see where it led me. That's an amazing thing, because I do think, you know, we spend so much of our time, some consciously, most unconsciously, doing everything we can not to feel the pain, and you know, from the pain of what's happened to us to the pain of what we're doing that we hate, but we do it anyway. We just keep doing it. And I just think, you know, most of us are saying, look, I'll do what I can, but I am not going to give in to this pain. I mean, give in to it. I mean, experience it. And yet it's amazing how pain is such a good guidance tool. It's so revealing if we'll experience it and follow it for a while.
Absolutely. You're right on. I believe I was so ingrained and my coping mechanisms were put in place at such a young age, I didn't have the ability to recognize the pain I was carrying. But it was a huge one, was shutting off work. I hid in work. I always had work. And so I could go to work to be able to occupy my mind and keep me busy. And that prevented me from feeling lonely, from feeling rejected, any of those things. And so turning that off allowed that to start to bubble, and, man, it was uncomfortable. It was really uncomfortable. I had to have on my fridge for that year the words for the five basic feeling groups, because I would experience something and would not be able to make the connection. And I'd have to go look at it and be like, am I mad? Am I glad? Am I sad? Am I scared? Or am I confused? Where does it fall? What am I feeling underneath that to start to make the connection? I was disconnected from my emotions. I had not been allowed to have my own emotions, and so I had learned to bury everything. And so it was the process of letting them start to come up, and then it was just foreign, just completely unusual and very uncomfortable, but to allow it to happen and say, okay, I need to stay present here, not escape it, and learn what it is and see what I'm being taught. I know you quote Dan Allender. Dan Allender has been a significant part of my growth, and he has a great quote. He says, if you're not willing to step into the truth, you will live a life that's small, conventional, and controlled. And it was really being able to see the truth for what it was that was allowing me to step away from my life that was conventional, without a doubt, and controlled. And in the bigger picture, it was pretty small.
Okay, so two questions, because we're going to be running out of time here. It's 10 till. One, just a real quick one for context. Did you literally not work for a year?
I did not work for a year.
And so you obviously had the ability to do that for a year of not working.
I did. I had been prudent financially. I had planned it. It was in late 2005 when I made the decision that I was going to do it. I had several big contracts that weren't going to wind out until 2007. And so I very consciously put in place limiting commitments that were going to extend beyond 2007 and being prudent so that I could disconnect for a year. And keep in mind, I'm single. I didn't have a family to support.
Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask you real quick. Sorry, we're off rhythm here, are we?
Go. You go.
Right. Okay. So what would you say to a person who they're thinking, you know, I need that reflection. I need to go into this journey that Jonathan is explaining, but I can't walk away from my work. And I mean from a financial standpoint, not from an emotional standpoint. Though that may be an issue, but financially they're saying, I can't do this. How would you tell them to try to accomplish the same thing?
And that is a great question, because it doesn't take the full sabbatical. I did not have healthy practice, healthy habits at all. And had I known, I also didn't have mentorship, which I've shared, but had I been able to start with steps, or for an individual to just start with steps and be able to, I did not have a Sabbath day. I worked a portion of every day. And so I never unplugged from the noise that was related to my profession, simply putting in place and being disciplined with a Sabbath day where you took that time for rest and reflection and recharge. That can be a very simple and very significant first step. Being intentional about creating the space where you can be quiet and be still, I think is significant.
What would you say is a significant time? In other words, a guy says, you know, every once in a while during the day I take 10 minutes and I'm quiet. Are you saying, no, I'm saying an entire day, 48 hours, or I'm saying, you know, and some significant hour periods during the week as well. What practice are you thinking about?
Boy, that's a great question. And I think it's probably different for each individual. I will tell you what works best for me. Small portions, even if it was an hour or two each day, is not as significant for me as if I take that day away. It's better for me to unplug for a longer period of time than it is to do it a smaller chunk over several periods of time. And a big part for me, I have to get unplugged enough for the noise to quiet down. I have a difficult time quieting myself to get to the point where I can hear the still small voice of God. It's very difficult for me to do that in an hour. There's a component of me where I lack the discipline to be doing that regularly and develop the ability to do that. But for me, I tend to run where the noise will get bigger, and then I will unplug, and it typically is unplugging where, and for me, it's getting alone outdoors in nature. That's where I sense the presence of God. That's where my thoughts tend to slow down, and I'm able to reflect, have a dialogue with God and be able to start to sense what's being said. So I think starting with something like that, if it can work where you're able to carve out the time during the day and that hour of quiet time, you know, early morning, late evening, whatever it is, and you're able to get to that space of quiet, I think that would be significant and would work. Another one, and Sam asked a question a while ago, and I didn't address it directly, but in terms of what I do now, 3 years ago I thought journaling was a joke, a waste of time. Based on my personal growth journey, journaling had a really big part of it. And journaling, just writing, helps me get in touch with the significant threads that are in my thought process and that are speaking to my heart as well.
Okay. That's good, and I'll tell you what, this has completely nailed me. I mean, I'm very aware of the fact that we need to pay attention to pain or to the five emotions you talked about. Be aware of it and ask the question why. But I'll tell you what I run to, and there's no doubt about what I run to is to buffer, alleviate the pain is work. And it's especially hard because I love my work, but I know, I've watched myself, I can look back at my life and I can say every time things get really hard for me, emotions start to bubble up, I go to work. That's what I do. And I could say, well, it's because I love it and because it's important, and those are both true, which makes it more difficult than running to something I hate and everybody else knows I hate it. But I'll tell you, that's what I do. I go to work, and just the thought of, honestly, I'm just being, you know, really honest with you and everyone listening right now, the thought of taking a week and not working at all, it sounds impossible to me. And that's not good. I mean, I'm laughing and I'm thinking I'm about to slap myself. You know?
Oh, but I was the same way, Gary. I cannot be accomplishing something was just incredibly hard for me. And so I was working with wise counsel with the therapist, and the advice was, be kind to yourself. Go and just reflect on what's coming up. And I was like, no, I want to go do this. And I hid in my activities too. And I said that was where I felt alive. And there was truth in that, because it was in my activities where I did feel emotions, the adrenaline, the fear, the exhilaration. Those were the only ones that I could connect with. But I had to recognize that I was running and hiding in those as well. And the turning it off and allowing the space, and it is, stuff kind of bubbles up is the best way I can put it. And then I'm able to journal, connect, start to connect with it. It's significant. One thing that you know that I do, I come regularly to Colorado, and for 20 years, travel was incredibly difficult. So I love doing that. And frequently, I will drive. And that, I get 2 days in the car, and commonly, and I take a different route every time, and I like getting off the beaten path. And commonly, I will not have anything on in the car. It's silent. And I'm reflecting, I'm seeing some new part of the country that I haven't seen, you know, going through a little town in the middle of Nebraska or whatever, and my thoughts are free to go in a way that doesn't happen when I've got to catch the plane or I've got an hour before the next plane. And so that, in a way, it's sort of forced, but it gives me that space to be able to reflect. And what's amazing, when I look back on my life, every major significant decision that I've made has been when I've unplugged. I made some significant decisions within my career while I was still an engineer, and they all came. They came where I was at the point where I'd had it. I had a break in my work, and I stepped out and away from it. And it was for a multiple week time. And I came back and made a big decision that was a good decision for me. And the same thing with my sabbatical. So that stepping away has led to clarity for making wise decisions.
Huh, okay. We could end with that. I mean, and we are out of time, but I just need to ask you one more question here in your story, and that is, so between the time way back and you started getting these, as you talked about, these cycles of unrest and the physical pain, you're starting to make some adjustments, but they're very small and they're within the same context, to where you are today, what did God use? How did God train you, develop you, give you skills that were going to be needed for what you're doing today? Just a few of those things.
Wow, that's a great question. Very significantly, every part of my story has shaped me into who I am today. And I believe there is power in story, and it's through my story that I am effective with what I'm doing, working with individuals. And so at the time, I didn't see any of it. But the experience that I had with the failure in relationship and the significant hurt and the pain that came with that, and then my walking through that and being able to see what I was bringing to the table, the component that I had in the context of that relationship, and now having the eyes to see it in myself, see it in others, and be able to see it in a way with kindness and compassion is significant. So from the hardship standpoint, absolutely, but also from the standpoint of seeing what I did and did naturally well, and it was unconscious, the changes that I made, I did not have a great strategic plan. I just had the unrest and recognized that something had to change, and my continual refinement was getting truer to what I did naturally well, to using my core strengths. The big component that was missing was I had completely buried discount in my heart and didn't believe that I could do something that would speak to my heart from a vocational standpoint. So that piece remained missing until the sabbatical. But in terms of, real quick, in my engineering practice, I differentiated myself from other consultants from the standpoint that I had to have my client own the solution that they were going to get. And the way I did that was I involved the whole team. It was the owner. It was the other design professionals who'd been involved in the project originally. It was the operations and maintenance staff, facilities management, and the end users. And as a team, I helped them see the heart of the problem, recognize what possibilities there could be, and I felt that if I did my job well, they would pick the solution that would be best for them. What I was doing, I was helping them do their best thinking, see possibilities, and make high-quality decisions. That's the definition of a strategic facilitator. I didn't even know what a strategic facilitator was, but I was doing that naturally. I gravitated to that, and that's what differentiated myself from other consultants. And so when I look back at it, from that standpoint, all of that came into play. I want to speak to it from a faith standpoint. I was a stoic. My faith really, there were several formative growth periods, but I believe I did not have the ability to discern truth until I started to step in to look at what really was truth. I did not have a sense of the leading of the Holy Spirit until these past several years. And now it's so wonderful when it occurs. I think I was dead to it because of the patterns that had been ingrained in me so much. I didn't have the ability to discern truth, and that came into play with the Holy Spirit as well. And so that didn't get awakened in me until I stepped into that personal journey.
That's amazing. You know, Jonathan, you've given us so many great insights just as you've gone through your story. And I'm just grateful for this. I sure hope, you know, you can maybe join us in September, because the guys are saying, gosh, I wish we could just be face-to-face talking.
I would love to do that. I'm going to see if I can make that happen for sure.
Yep. So, Jonathan, thank you. I mean, we could easily go another hour. You and I could. Time-wise, I don't know. But anyway, thank you for doing this, and maybe we could do it again. And thanks for sharing your life. It's been fascinating. I've learned a lot from you, so thank you.
Thanks, Gary. I believe there's power in story, and for me, and you're familiar with Dan Allender as well. He's got a formative book, To Be Told, which is about telling story, and it's my stepping into telling my story is a significant part for my growth, and I see that it's through my brokenness and my story that I'm able to touch and connect with others. So it's an honor and privilege to be able to do it here.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I'd love to do this again with you, because there's so much more
in
life I know we haven't touched, but thank you. And everybody, thank you for being on the call. This has been really good. And we'll get back together next week on a phone call. So thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Gary.
All right. See ya.
Good night.
Night.